Coming up on Star Stuff, history made as the first spacecraft successfully lands on a comet. Astronomers peering deep into the heart of a supernova see the first hints of the never-before-witnessed birth of a neutron star. And as many as half the stars in the universe may be celestial orphans flung out of their galaxies during colossal galactic collisions. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
After a journey of over a decade covering more than 6 billion kilometres, the European Space Agency has made history by successfully landing a probe on the surface of a comet. The Philae lander touched down on the frozen crust of Comet 67P Sheremov-Gerasimenko 7 hours after being deployed by its Rosetta mothership, which was orbiting 22.5 kilometres above the 10 billion tonne mountain of rock and ice. Rosetta mission manager Stefan Ulamek told the world about the successful touchdown.
The landing gear has been moved inside, so we are sitting on the surface. Philae is talking to us, more data to come and to be analyzed right now. The flywheel is going down, which it should do, of course. We are there, it's done its job. We are on the comet.
Comet 67P is a 4.5 kilometer wide charcoal-colored space rock made up of two bodies melded together, rotating every 12.4 hours and speeding through the solar system at 18 kilometers per second on a 6.5 year elliptical orbit around the Sun. The Rosetta mission is helping scientists find answers about the formation of the solar system, how Earth got its water, and maybe even how life began on Earth. Comets are the builder's rubble left over from the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. They're the solar system's oldest unmodified bodies. Unlike the Earth and other nearby objects, the interiors of comets contain primordial material which has not been cooked up and changed by the sun's radiation. Comets can answer questions not just about what the solar system's made of, but also where Earth's water came from. And scientists want to study the complex carbon chemistry in comets, which they think could be responsible for the amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, and consequently maybe the building blocks of life on Earth. In fact, the Murchison meteorite, which crashed near the Victorian town of Murchison in 1969, contained over 100 different types of amino acids. And scientists believe this meteorite may have once been the core of an evaporated comet. The Director General of the European Space Agency, Jean-Jacques Dordain, says it's been a remarkable achievement.
This is a big step for human civilization. And because this is science, scientist, knowledge, and that this is certainly terrestrial intelligence, that makes a difference. The biggest problem of success is that it looks easy. And when you know the sum of expertise, the sum of dedication, the sum of team working. When you know that, you know that this type of success is not coming from the sky.
Philae's touchdown on Comet 67P only had a 50% chance of success. Analysis showed that 20% of the comet's landing site was strewn with huge boulders capable of tipping the lander over. Another 20% had slopes greater than 30 degrees, making it too steep to land on. And 10% contained steep crevasses and cliffs up to 100 metres high. Australian avionics systems engineer Warwick Holmes, who helped build Rosetta for the European Space Agency, says the surface of Comet 67P was far rougher than anyone had predicted. The entire Philae landing sequence took place 510 million kilometres from Earth, with signals from Rosetta taking 28 minutes and 20 seconds to reach mission control in Darmstadt, Germany. Rosetta deployed Philae at 8 o'clock on Wednesday evening at an altitude of about 20 kilometres above the comet's surface. The automated descent took 7 hours, with the lander dropping at a rate of just 3 kilometres per hour. On the way down, Philae began imaging and taking scientific measurements of the environment around the comet. The historic touchdown was confirmed just after 3 o'clock Australian Eastern Daylight Time on the morning of Thursday, November 13. However, it seems Philae landed on unusually soft ground. So soft, the harpoons, which are supposed to anchor the lander to the surface, failed to fire, and Fillet bounced off the surface, rotating slightly before coming down again and finally settling on the comet's frozen surface. This bounce disrupted the radio link between the lander and the Rosetta orbiter, delaying the transmission of the first images until Rosetta was back in position overhead to receive the data and relay it back to Earth. Fillet Science payload includes a mass spectrometer and a gas chromatographer to analyze the molecular and mineralogical composition of the cometary material both on and below the surface. It also has a seismic sounder to ping signals into the comet, undertake sonar soundings, and an RF tomography unit to transmit radio waves right through the comet to Rosetta, providing data on the comet's internal structure. There's a drill to pull up subsurface primordial material from below the crust and a physical science probe to hammer up to 30 centimeters into the comet to measure temperatures and electrical properties below the surface. About an hour after touchdown, Fillet began its scientific mission, which should last about 64 to 72 hours, the expected lifetime of its onboard batteries. Small solar panels on the lander generate enough power to keep monitoring surface conditions and perform some follow-up experiments as the comet gets closer to the sun. However, Fillet is only expected to operate for about 3 or 4 months, as it's designed to survive in the very cold environment of the comet's icy surface, and so will eventually fail when it gets too hot, which will happen as the comet gets closer to the sun. By that time, Fillet will have done its job, and the Rosetta orbiter, which is undertaking 80% of the science research, will continue to study the comet for another 15 months. Comet 67P makes its closest approach to the sun on August the 12th next year. Warwick Holmes says the mission was always a risky endeavour, but the successful landing on the surface of Comet 67P is the icing on the cake.
Oh, look, Stuart, there aren't words in the English language to express how happy I am at the moment. Just, you know, we've been waiting for these two really critical events. The first one was, of course, the separation of the lander from the orbiter. And for about 2.5 minutes, you know, the faces of the people in the control room, they looked really unhappy. And we were thinking, oh, no, you know, if it hasn't separated, there's a problem. But it was just delayed telemetry. Then it came through and we got a perfect separation. That's really been the major success today, was that the delivery, they believe the error was only 15 centimetres from the target. You know, but I still can't believe that number, and I'm still thinking they still have to assess the data again. We were told there were going to be errors of hundreds and hundreds of metres possibly, but it seems that we came down within 15 centimetres.
And all legs facing down?
All legs facing down. Now, there has been a problem, and that is that when the lander touched down, the two harpoons didn't fire. And it seems that we've touched down on a very soft material, and the way we know that is there's a shock absorber which compresses as we touch down, and it's absorbing some of the kinetic energy to stop us rebounding. And that's designed to go down to anything up to 16 centimetres, and it only compressed 4, which means that most of the energy was being dissipated by the very soft material that the landing pads came down onto. And maybe it came down so softly that we didn't have enough energy to actually trigger the signal to fire the harpoons. So this is what we're looking at. And it seems that we did a very, very soft bounce too, because the solar panels measured a change in their current, and we actually lost the radio signal for a few minutes. And that seems to be when we bounced off very slowly and we turned around and we came back down again the second time. Then the radio signals came back and the current stabilized. So there's an indication that we actually did a small bounce, but we're getting good science data now, and so it's all working extremely well, except we have to get the harpoons in again.
The spacecraft itself, the lander, is it healthy?
It's healthy. It's very healthy, but we do need to get the harpoons in to stop us from pushing
floating
off
away.
There's a drill and there's a hammer probe, and we have to anchor ourselves well before we start driving those in.
I take it you've been there since the screws were retracted and the lander was deployed. What's the mood been like in Darmstadt?
Well, look, there's been many people here, Stuart, who've been involved in the project for anything up to 30 years. Myself, I've been waiting 15 years because my first involvement was 15 years ago when I started working on the project, and I worked on it for 4 years doing the building, the testing and the launch. So everyone who's been involved in the building process has been waiting at least a minimum of 10 and a half years to get to this point today. And, you know, all the time we knew what the mission was meant to do, and we had this sort of anticipation of what to expect, but nothing comes anywhere close to what actually happened today in terms of the tension and the euphoria and the, you know, normally we have these very stoic, conservative, well-behaved engineers and scientists. Well, they were screaming like children today, Stuart. It was incredible.
When you get a moment, you haven't got much time, but when you get a spare 3 seconds, stop, look around and realize what you're doing history.
Stuart, I just cannot believe I'm having this conversation with you. I mean, I'm not normally a pessimistic person by any means, but I did never believe that this was going to work so well.
That's Australian avionics systems engineer Warwick Holmes, who helped build the Rosetta probe for the European Space Agency. Rosetta is named after the Rosetta Stone, which helped archaeologists decipher ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. Philae is named after a Nile River island and temple complex, which housed an obelisk containing hieroglyphs used to help understand parts of the Rosetta Stone's hieroglyphics. The primary landing site, originally simply known as Site J, was renamed Ajilkia after an island in the Nile where the temple complex from Philae was moved to make way for the waters of Lake Nasser following the completion of the Aswan Dam. NASA's discovered that Comet C-2013A1 sighting spring, which sailed past Mars last month, spawned an intense meteor storm and added a new layer of ions or charged particles into the Martian ionosphere. Scientists say the comet gave the red planet's twilight skies a yellowish glow because of all the sodium in the vaporized comet dust. The ionosphere is an electrically charged region in the atmosphere that stretches up to about 120 kilometers above the Martian surface. The numbers suggest many thousands of shooting stars per hour, resulting in what would have been a spectacular night on Mars. Data from observations carried out by NASA's MAVEN and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft, as well as the European Space Agency's Mars Express, studied comet sighting spring as it passed just 139,500 kilometres above the red planet. Now, to put that in perspective, that's less than half the distance between the Earth and the Moon, and about 10 times closer than any known comet encounter with the Earth. Measurements taken before and after sighting spring's approach show significant changes in Mars's upper atmosphere, including the addition of a new layer of charged particles and telltale chemical signatures of 8 different metal ions, including sodium, magnesium, and iron shed by the passing comet. The new observations represent the first ever direct connection between the input of debris from a meteor shower and the subsequent formation of a transient layer of ions. Not only is the first time this event's been seen on Mars, it's the first time the event's been observed on any planet, including Earth. Comet sighting spring also left another imprint on Mars, depositing thousands of kilograms of dust into the atmosphere, far more than computer models had predicted. Not even the most intense meteor storms on Earth have produced as strong a response as this one. In fact, the emission dominated Mars's ultraviolet spectrum for several hours after the encounter, and then slowly dissipated over the next 2 days. These data represent the first direct measurements of the composition of dust from a rare Oort cloud comet. The Oort cloud is a region of icy debris and frozen bodies orbiting the Sun at and beyond the edge of the solar system. The cloud contains a mixture of comets and leftovers from the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago, as well as objects from interstellar space that have been snared by the Sun's gravitational pull as it moves through the galaxy. NASA's head of planetary science, Jim Green, thinks comet sighting spring had probably never been to the inner solar system before. That means the material in this comet has never been cooked up by the Sun and so has remained preserved in a deep freeze. NASA and ESA moved their constellation of orbiting spacecraft so they would be behind Mars and shielded from dust and debris impacts during the peak of the storm. The analysis is ongoing to determine the comet's size, its exact composition, as well as other attributes. The comet's named after the Siding Spring Observatory in outback New South Wales, from where famous comet hunter Dr. Rob McNaught discovered the icy object last year. Astronomers peering deep into the heart of a supernova are seeing the first hints of what could be the never-before-witnessed birth of a neutron star. Supernova 1987A was seen to suddenly explode on February 23, 1987, on the edge of the Tarantula Nebula in a nearby dwarf galaxy 168,000 light-years away called the Large Magellanic Cloud. The explosion was easily visible from Earth with the unaided eye. This was one of the nearest core collapse supernova explosions of modern times, giving scientists an unprecedented opportunity to study the cataclysmic event in great detail. The new research, which has been reported in the Astrophysical Journal, detected signs of a pulsar wind nebula generated by a spinning neutron star, which appears to be slightly offset westwards from the supernova's position. The study's lead author, Dr. Giovanna Zanardo, from the University of Western Australia node of the International Centre of Radio Astronomy Research, says it's the youngest neutron star candidate she's ever seen. If this really is a pulsar as expected, then it will have solved a quarter-century-old mystery about exactly what supernova 1987A created. The progenitor star was a blue supergiant, about 20 times the mass of our Sun, which has been identified through archival images as Sandalique minus 69 degrees 202. It's also known as GSC 09162-00821. The discovery, therefore, answers a mystery often pondered by astronomers. You see, usually supernovae from progenitor stars greater than 20 solar masses are thought to produce black holes, while those smaller than 20 solar masses leave behind neutron stars. But exactly what would a supernova produce if the progenitor star was exactly 20 solar masses? Well, based on the 1987A results, it looks like we may now know the answer is a neutron star. Neutron stars are the extremely dense stellar cores of stars much more massive than the Sun, which have blown off their outer layers in supernova explosions bright enough to briefly outshine an entire galaxy. A neutron star's caught a pulsar when its rotation can be detected as a pulse of radiation, usually in radio waves, causing the object to look like a lighthouse beam sweeping across the cosmos. Zanardo and colleagues used the Australia Telescope Compact Array at Narrabri in northwestern New South Wales and the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array in Chile to observe the supernova remnant at wavelengths spanning both radio and far infrared frequencies. This allowed the authors to distinguish radiation emitted by the supernova's expanding shock wave from radiation being caused by dust condensing out of the gas in the inner regions of the remnant. Now, at this point, Zanardo and colleagues are seeing a diffused emission, a faint glow, which is going through the dust and material at the centre of the supernova. Zanardo says she's sure there's a neutron star hidden inside the dust, but final confirmation will have to wait until a pulsar signal can be picked up by an observatory such as the Parkes Radio Telescope. Tantalising hints of a possible neutron star in 1987A were first reported 14 years ago by John Middleditch and colleagues in New Astronomy when they used several telescopes, including one at the University of Tasmania, to detect a 2.14 millisecond pulse signal coming from 1987A at a frequency of 467.5 Hz. However, the authors couldn't be certain that this signal was actually being generated by a pulsar. As for the latest study, Zanardo says a possible answer is getting closer.
We see this sort of diffuse emission, so we know there is something under, and we kind of see the glow around it, which is going through the dust and all the material which is in the center. So, yeah, we are one step closer. We are so close. We see this indirect evidence, but we never seen any neutron star so young. The one we found already, I mean, we found so many pulses already in the galaxy and outside the galaxy. They are a million years old. Mm. So also the physics an object would have, you know, at such a young age is completely different. That's why everybody's scratching their head and say it's happening this or maybe it's not happening this. So the youngest we discovered that was like already 1,000 years old. So it's completely different stage. So yeah, we'll be the first time we see really the little step of this object as it comes through, as it becomes strong enough for us to capture.
Now that the material, the interstellar material, is cooling down and forming dust, what's the supernova remnant look like?
It's so interesting because every time, basically, we get our data, it's a new image.
Yeah, it's been changing ever since the blast.
Yeah, and this is I think, the beauty of this type of study. When you study object like a supernova that evolves in real time, it's exciting every time you just check new observation. What's happening, it's interesting because there is new dust formation. There was an article we worked earlier this year that essentially was tracking all the dust in the center. But this dust is sort of expanding on one side, and on the other side, of course, is kind of rearranging its shape. So we see this sort of blobbish dust in the center. But with ALMA, we can actually localize the densest part of the dust. So you can actually see a very, very small area where all the dust is, which is very nicely overlapping with the images they had with the Hubble telescope. It's interesting because the dust seems to be pretty much in the center, like geometrically speaking. Mm. The hourglass is already there.
Yeah.
The hourglass was the way the transition happened. This was originally a very large star. It was a red supergiant that changed its status and evolved into a smaller star that is called blue supergiant. And at that point, there was the explosion. In the transition from red to blue, there was this sort of interaction with all the different winds of the two stars, because the one from the blue will be faster and the one from the red supergiant will be denser. So the interaction of this has come out with this incredible shape, which is the hourglass.
What causes a red giant to become a blue giant?
We know only a little bit, but what happens is a star starts to become bigger, expands a lot. And by doing this, it just increases the size a lot. At some point, there is some sort of contraction. So it depends, of course, on how much is involved. So if the star, once it reaches red supergiant state, starts to contract, then it becomes a bit denser. And then it's where I change it and becomes a blue supergiant.
It contracts, and that's when it starts burning different material?
Yeah, I think that is a sort of fusion. So you might have that, you reach a stage where the instead of expanding, the different layer of the star start to fall inwards toward the center. And so the gravitational
increases heat and pressure
again, and and so comes, and then it might actually change again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like a sort of contracting and expanding, really. And then it might expand again, it might again a red supergiant, then go back again. This type of explosion only happened from red supergiants. So it was very surprising for astronomers at the time to find out it was actually a star that already contracted to blue at that time exploded. So because of this transition, then we have all these complex material that surrounds the site of the supernova. So we have this wonderful equatorial ring that keeps giving these incredible images, and then we have this hourglass shape.
That's Dr. Giovanna Zanardo from the University of Western Australia. A new study has concluded that there could be as many stars in the intergalactic space between galaxies as there are in galaxies themselves. The findings, reported in the journal Science, are based on observations collected during four suborbital rocket missions carried out by NASA between 2009 and 2013 as part of the Cosmic Infrared Background Experiment, CIBER. CIBER measured background fluctuations in a compilation of all the lights emitted by stars and galaxies in the universe's history. Two of NASA's Black Brant 12 suborbital-sounding rockets were launched from the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico and two more from the Wallops Island Flight Facility in Virginia. The data from these suborbital flights was then compared to observations from NASA's Earth-orbiting Spitzer Infrared Space Telescope. The new findings imply as many as half the stars in the universe may be celestial orphans, stars flung out of their host galaxies during colossal galactic collisions. The phenomenon of orphan stars has been well documented, with astronomers often seeing tidal streams of stars being stripped away from colliding pairs of galaxies. Galaxies like our own Milky Way are made up of stars, dust, and dark matter bound together by gravity. As galaxies drift through space, they periodically gravitationally interact with each other, resulting in mergers and galactic collisions. The Milky Way, in fact, is colliding with a Sagittarius dwarf galaxy right now. And it's starting to also tidally strip stars of two other satellite galaxies, the Large and the Small Magellanic Clouds. While many star systems and clouds of gas and dust emerged into larger galaxies by this process, the new CIBER findings show that just as many stars are stripped away and flung out deep into intergalactic space by the same gravitational forces. In fact, the data indicates huge numbers of orphan stars previously undetected populate what was thought to be the dark spaces between galaxies. They found that the dim light these stars produce from the far reaches of the cosmos equals the amount of light coming from all the galaxies. Now, these orphan stars can't actually be seen individually because they're too far away. Instead, astronomers can detect the glowing haze made by these billions upon billions of stars. The findings are profound. In fact, they could redefine what astronomers think of as galaxies. It means galaxies may not have set boundaries of stars, but instead stretch out to great distances, forming what is actually a vast interconnected sea of stars. The study's lead author, Caltech experimental astrophysicist Michael Zemkov from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, says the data suggests orphan stars are usually probably relatively small, less massive and cooler than the Sun. When you think about it, that's to be expected. After all, most stars in our galaxy alone are smaller and less massive than the Sun. Living on a planet orbiting one of these orphan stars would be a unique experience by our standards. While the night sky as seen from Earth is brimming with starlight, planets orbiting orphan stars would be so distant from other stars that the night skies would offer almost complete darkness. No other stars, or at least very few, and no Milky Way band. If you're lucky, you may see your parent galaxy off in the distance, sort of like we see Andromeda as a faint smudge of light. Three Expedition 41 crew members have returned safely to Earth following a 165-day mission aboard the International Space Station. Their Soyuz TMA-13M capsule parachuted down onto the frozen Kazakhstan steppe northeast of the remote town of Akaliak 3.5 hours after undocking from the orbiting outpost. Their 5.5 month stay on the station included research into Earth remote sensing, advanced manufacturing techniques, and a study of bone and muscle physiology. A key research focus during Expedition 41 has been human health management during long-duration space travel. This is important as both NASA and the Russian space agency Roscosmos prepare for two crew members to spend a year aboard the space station beginning in 2015. During their time on station, the Expedition 41 crew welcomed 5 cargo ships. 2 Russian Progress cargo ships docked to the station bringing several tons of supplies, one in July and the other in October. The 5th and final European ATV cargo ship, named the Georges Lemaître after the Belgian physicist, considered the father of Big Bang theory, also flew to the station in July. A third arrival for the month of July was the second scheduled Orbital Sciences Cygnus cargo ship on a resupply mission under contract for NASA. Another Cygnus was scheduled to arrive this month, but was destroyed when its Antares launch vehicle failed shortly after liftoff from the Wallops Island Flight Facility in Virginia. SpaceX also launched another Dragon cargo ship to the space station in September, the company's 4th commercial resupply mission under its NASA contract. 2 extravehicular activities, or EVAs, which is NASA speak for spacewalks, were conducted during the mission as well. These carried out various housekeeping duties, including relocating a failed pump module and reconfiguring the station for the arrival of a new module. In addition to being a scientific research platform, the space station also serves as a testbed to demonstrate new technology. And among that technology to make it to the space station was the first 3D printer to be tested in space. This will be the first step towards establishing an on-demand machine shop in space, which is a crucial enabling component for deep space crewed missions and in-space manufacturing. A new Earth monitoring instrument called RapidSCAT was also installed and activated on the space station during the crew's time in orbit. RapidSCAT will measure Earth's ocean surface wind speeds and direction, essential measurements used for weather prediction. With the departure of the last 3 Expedition 41 crew members, the Expedition 42 crew now take over station operations. 3 current on-station members will be joined later this month by 3 additional crew members slated to fly aboard the Soyuz TMA-15 mission from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. The International Space Station has been forced to undertake an emergency manoeuvre just hours before it risked being hit by a deadly chunk of space debris. The thrusters aboard the European Space Agency's ATV cargo ship Georges Lemaître were fired up to move the $100 billion orbiting outpost and its 6 occupants out of harm's way after mission controllers detected a piece of Russia's Cosmos 2251 satellite on a collision course with the space station. The Cosmos 2251 had broken up after colliding with another satellite back in 2009. The debris, which was about the size of a bowling ball, would have passed within a 4-kilometer safety envelope surrounding the space station, and that was far too close for comfort. In close coordination with the ISS control centers in Moscow and Houston, the ATV control center in Toulouse triggered a 4-minute thruster burn of 1.8 kilometers per hour, enough to raise the 420-ton space station by a kilometer out of harm's way. This is the first time the station's international partners have avoided space debris with such urgency. Ground stations are continually tracking space junk. Even an object as small as a fleck of paint can cause major damage when it's travelling at 28,800 kilometres per hour. When the alarm is raised, mission managers move the space station to a safer orbit. Problem is, sometimes calculations can take hours. Other times, a dangerous piece of space junk can slip through the net without being detected, or the erratic behavior of space junk can make accurate predictions more difficult. The helping hand from Georges Lemaître was one of the last tricks up the ATV's sleeve. After delivering more than 6.5 tons of supplies, fuel and water, the ATV will be undocked in February and then deorbited to burn up in the atmosphere. And that's the show for now. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can also subscribe to the show as a weekly podcast through iTunes or download it from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. You can also check out the Star Stuff blog, which contains all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular images and the funny things I find on the net. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And don't forget the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations, and publishing details. Just type in the @ symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word and in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.